Today our text is from the end of Deuteronomy chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5 in Deuteronomy. And our question to begin with this morning is, how are commands true or false? It's a rather straightforward question when you think about it. If I would tell you something like, close the door, true or false? You'd say, it's not a statement subject to the criteria of true or false. If I say to you, turn on the lights or turn off the lights, it's not a statement that we typically say can either be true or false. It's a command. It's a direction. It's an expectation. If we say something like walk slowly, or if you're driving and you see a sign that says caution, don't drive too fast for conditions, we wonder about things, whether or not you could actually say they were true or false. The psalmist in Psalm 119 says all God's commands are true. In verse 151. And we have to ask ourselves this question. How is it that a command can be true or false? You see, so much of what we're studying in the book of Deuteronomy is about God providing laws, decrees, in the Hebrew Torah, to His people and asking them to live according to it. They are to regard it as God's true word to them. And their lives are to reflect that these directions, these decrees, these statements, things sometimes as ordinary as walk slowly, walk this way, close the door or turn on the lights, are regarded as true. There's a way of understanding how words do things, and it's important that we understand it. So I provided for you on the outline statements that linguists would use to understand how commands or how precepts or ordinances or directions can be regarded as true or false. And it's simply an explanation of locution, illocution, and perlocution. Locution means simply to make a statement, to stand, sit, a command, close the door, or even something as unobtrusive as it's cold in here or it's hot in here. A locution is simply a statement. Now, what's interesting is what one does with a statement like that. Illocution has to do with the force or how people would hear or perceive a statement. You see, if we hear God say to us, I saved you, it's simply a statement. But if there is a relationship between God and His people, when God tells us He saves us, that binds us up with God in such a way that we understand that our lives have been literally provided for. We have been delivered and given the opportunity to live by God. Now, perlocution simply means the actions we undertake in keeping with how we hear the locution. For example, if we had a healthy relationship, and if I said to you, it's hot in here, if you heard that as somebody who, in relationship with me, wanted to see something appropriate happen, you might adjust the temperature. You might open a window. You might offer that I would be able to remove my coat. You might do that in any number of things, even though I never asked you or said to you that those were the things you would do. But certain actions, because of the relationship, are regarded as appropriate. Everything from I'm cold in here to have no other gods before me, as we are told in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Let me give you a couple examples. Almost 22 years ago, I love the spring. It was the time when I met Anita. I'd met her before then, my wife, but I'd met her before then, but didn't really notice her until one day I looked at her and I said, That's all I'll tell you. I did think more, but it's not the time or the place to think that or even to say it. She mentioned just in passing in a conversation with somebody else that she liked bananas. It was simply a statement, a locution. I heard that, though, because of my interest in her, as if it were a direct command. Thou shalt go forth hitherto immediately and retrieve thence a banana at the right stage of ripeness. I went out that afternoon and shopped for a banana. You ever see people in the store just going through the bunches and picking out the perfect banana or bananas? That was me 22 years ago. I even removed the sticker from the one banana, and I put it on the banana that I was getting because it was from Ecuador, and Anita had been to Ecuador, and it was going to be something that would be particularly personal. And I retrieved it. Of course, being very cool and nonchalant, I just walked in with a few other things that I had to buy. Anything. Didn't matter. I went for the banana, but I wasn't going to let her know that. And I just showed up and I said, oh, she said you go to the store. Yeah, I got a couple things. Oh, really? I said, here, I got an extra banana. If you want it. There you go. And this continued for several weeks until she made a comment about how she also liked chocolate. Now, I wasn't sure whether or not she'd figured out that I was listening, but here it is. The locution is simply, I like banana, or I like chocolate. The illocutionary force is that I heard that as an opportunity to please her because of the relationship that I was hoping to have. And after almost 22 years of marriage, it seemed to have worked. And the perlocutionary action was me going to the store, fumbling around through bananas, finding a banana and removing the sticker from one and putting it on that one and bringing it back. That was the perlocutionary action. Now, about chocolates, by the way, she mentioned chocolates and then she had to further specify. It was not only chocolate, it was a certain type of chocolate and then by a certain manufacturer, but they recently went out of business, so now I don't know what I'm going to do. Hopefully we'll make it to 23 years. But at this point, I need to tell you that it's a simple way of understanding how words function. Most of what we call Torah, or most of how we regard the book of Deuteronomy, is simply God's directions, telling people what he prefers. I like this. I don't like that. I want to see this. Sometimes I don't want to see that happen. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 44 reads, "This is the law that Moses set before the Israelites." Verse 45, "These are the decrees and the statutes and the ordinances," three different words, four words total that talk about how God is going to give direction to the Israelites, "that Moses spoke to the Israelites when they had come out of Egypt." That phrase, "come out of Egypt," is the same way of saying, "I delivered you." The God who delivers his people now gives them directions or instructions about how they will live together. How their relationship, or the word in the Bible to talk about that relationship is covenant. How their explicit agreement with one another will be lived out. On what basis it will be evaluated. Verse 1 of chapter 5. "Moses convened all Israel, gathered them together, and said to them, 'Hear, O Israel.'" And by the way, the phrase "hear" is another way of saying, "listen so that you may act." That is, it's a simple locution. Hear. Pay attention in such a way that you will listen to it and act in a way. Here's the locution. Hear the statutes of the Lord. The illocutionary force of that is, since you have been delivered by God out of Egypt and given a way of life, literally the opportunity to live because of that deliverance from Egypt, this is what God is making explicit with his people about how they may please him and how he may please them. Making it explicit. That's the illocutionary force. The perlocutionary action would be that they obey. So he goes on and says, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and ordinances that I am addressing you today, and you shall learn them and observe them diligently." Perlocutionary actions. That is, the actions undertaken in light of the statements made, based on the force of how they would hear the statements. Verse 2, "The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. Not with our ancestors did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the fire. At the time, I was standing between the Lord and you to declare you the words of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire and did not go up to the mountain. And he said," verse 6, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." Verse 8, "You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above or that is on the earth beneath and that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I am the Lord your God. I am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of parents to the third and fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commands." Today we need to understand what God is telling us, to hear the locution, to feel the force of that statement, what it means to feel the force of God saying, "I saved you." and what actions, the perlocutionary actions we would undertake to show that we have not only understood, but that we have perceived the force of that simple statement, I saved you out of the land of Egypt. The structure for this larger section begins in verse 44 of chapter 4 and reaches into the beginning of chapter 6. I provided the outline for you. There's one of the, as in understanding the panels of the book of Deuteronomy, there is a framework, a highly stylized form of writing, which is meant to communicate something to us. If you follow the logic of the structure, the penultimate point, the zenith, the apex of the commands, it's not any different or more important. It's simply, as it were, the point or the rationale for saying everything that comes before it, leads up to it, and leads away from it. And I've diagrammed it for you as a chiasmus. It's simply a way of saying this. I'm going to give you these words, and these words have meaning, and they have force, and you will listen to them and observe them if you perceive this. What's this? Verse 15. The this is, remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. If we understand that, the writer is telling us, we will understand the simple words of God and how it is that a command can be true and life to us. Along the way, he talks about his covenant and his appearance. He tells them about how they're supposed to be exclusive in their worship, and he provides for them what we would usually call simply the Ten Commandments. The most basic, the most widely known and understood section of Torah, of law, in what we would refer to as the Old Testament. And I'll let you follow the structure. We'll do it this week and next week and the following week, and we'll go through the incidents and the elements of these statements. So let's jump in and find out what it is that we are being told in this preface, in this panel that leads us to law. The first thing you notice at the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5 is that the Lord was explicit and showed up to speak with his people. Some things he said directly to them and other things were mediated through Moses. We learned from chapter 4 earlier on that the people actually only heard the 10 words or 10 commands of God. The rest was given to Moses that he would bring to the people. That is, the people were afraid of a God who would be so explicit as to speak or meet with them and address them personally. Have you ever gone to someone and had to tell them, to give them directions about something, something they would have to do, probably knowing that they would be not only at one point fail this, but they would be held to a certain standard, simply to make explicit and to make somebody responsible for actions? Like telling somebody at work, as a boss would tell an employee or as you would be directed by your boss to tell somebody else, tell them that they have to do this job. And they have to do it in the right way, and if they don't, there will be consequences to that. And if they obey, if they do this job well, there will be benefits to it. It's a scene of confrontation. And many of us, simply by personality or demeanor, don't relish confrontation. We think of it as an unhealthy sign to actually enjoy confrontation, to live and thrive on the moment of animosity or excitement with someone. And we regard that as a personality fault rather than as a personality strength. So that leaves Donald Trump out of the mix. But nonetheless, what we do have is a confrontation in which we are told explicitly in chapter 4, verse 12, the Lord spoke to you out of the fire. You heard the sound of his voice, saw no form. There was only a voice. He declared to you his covenant, which he charged you to observe. That is the 10 words or commands, and he wrote them on 2 stones. And the Lord charged me, Moses, at that time to teach you statutes and ordinances for you to observe in the land that you are about to cross into and occupy. They heard the 10 words, but Moses was given the responsibility of displaying for them the actions, the perlocutionary actions, which would show that they had understood the 10 words. Now, if you've been taught that the 10 words are, in a nutshell, a statement of basic human conduct as God gave the Israelites a way to live, then you've been taught something that is probably appropriate. And that the entire law is summed up and illustrated in 10 simple words about God, about neighbor, about family, about stealing, not stealing actually, about actions that we would undertake with one another, and that there is, as it were, a summary or a shorthand or almost a rudimentary or a basic explanation about how God expects his people to live. The caveat to that would be to be careful, because these are laws or directions given to God's people after they have experienced their redemption, their deliverance from slavery. The Ten Commands have become sort of a cultural symbol of right and wrong within society, ask Judge Roy Moore in Alabama or anybody else, and that's probably a misrepresentation of the law. The law is given to God's people after He delivered them so that they, in their relationship with God, having been delivered by God, can understand actions which build on and elucidate that relationship that I am the God who saved you. They are not generic moral standards applicable. We have to stop asking people to act like those who have relationship with God, place burdens and the onus on them, expect them to act like good little Christian people when they do not know Christ. That is inappropriate. There are cultural standards in the law of the land, and those things are derived from what the country or what the people in a location will bear. But there is, these directions are given to God's people after they've experienced redemption so that they may orient their lives, and they depend. Their truthfulness in the lives of the listeners depends on their appreciating this. The same God who brought them out of the land of Egypt asks them to live in a way that shows they have perceived the gravity and significance of what it means to be given a new life to live. If you have not been granted that new life to live, then these words should fall on your ears as if you were lacking hearing. These words, their locutionary force, that illocutionary force, is meant to play on relationship. Relationship which is, as Paul described in 1 Corinthians 6, you were bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your bodies. Or as Paul said in Romans chapter 6, you were once a slave to sin, but now being freed from slavery to sin, you have become enslaved to God in Christ. Therefore do not any longer let sin rule in your bodies. All of the injunctions about following a certain way of life are not generally applicable to the culture in which we live. They are specifically applicable, and we bear the burden, the onus, the responsibility of living like we know the God who says things like, I saved you. Now, Moses specifically tells them that they should regard Torah almost like we would regard a love letter. Like you would hear statements of appreciation and directions. Like I heard words from that young girl, Anita. Torah is regarded more as a love letter, as a direct form of address given to people in a specific way, face to face, so that you may hear. And then the explanation of it through Moses, so that you may follow through, and so that your actions in all the varieties of life, in all the various circumstances, should reflect that we know God and that we know Him because He has delivered us or saved us out of slavery. We did not have a life, but God gives us a life through redemption. That is, we are taught how to learn God. Not just about God, not just knowing about God, not being able to recite the things that make God happy or make God unhappy, but to literally know the Lord in Torah, to know the Lord by means of His commands, so that when we hear words like decrees, statutes, ordinances, when we hear Jesus say that I know you love me if you obey my commands. You see, love and obedience within contemporary culture are usually thought of as contradictory. You either do something because you have to, obedience, or you do something because you want to. And we always assume that doing something because your heart wants to is always of a more virtuous or higher moral plane than it is to do things out of compulsion or necessity. And yet Jesus is able to say, I know you are my disciples, and I know you love me if you obey my commands. We know that Jesus is this in His relationship with His Father, according to John's Gospel. We know that the Father's love is in place with the Son because the Son always does the things which please the Father. The Gospel teaches us, like Torah teaches us, a different moral ordering of life. We should stop thinking about statutes and ordinances and command and obedience as somehow a lower or lesser form of life. And that conditions all the experiences of life. Everything from, I had to do it because somebody told me to do it with authority. There are a lot of things that you and I have to do in our lives, which we simply have to do because of the construct of our lives, to pay bills, to take care of our responsibilities, to be of use to other people. We have to keep a certain calendar. We have to go to work or not go to work. We don't get to call in and say, not only am I sick, or maybe we can't even call in and say, I'm too well to come into work today. We are to bear the responsibilities that we have, not simply because they are responsibilities, but we are to bear responsibilities, as Paul said, as those who labor or serve God, not just another human being. You see, obedience is not of a lesser plane. Obedience is as a coordinate of love, which is why faith and obedience and love are synonymous with each other in how we would narrate our response to God's relationship with us. Our lives throughout the New Testament and the Old are directed by the relationship of things like faith, trust, obedience, and love. They are not antithetical. They do not exclude one another. They show one another that there is appreciation and responsiveness, that commands and directions and decrees and law, Torah, is not heard as burdensome, but is heard as blessing. So we are told here that Torah is much like a direct address, like a love letter. It's how we learn God. And it's how we learn the one thing we should want to do above all else: please God. It's also something interesting you notice in the description about how the Lord addresses us. In chapter 5, in this setting, in the early chapters of Deuteronomy, the Lord tells us through Moses, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and ordinances that I am addressing to you today. You shall learn them and observe them diligently. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. Not with our ancestors did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today." Some of you actually look alive today, at least in spirit. Moses is telling the people, you may not only not live off the past, our relationship with God is evaluated on our hearing today, our diligently doing as the Lord commands us today. Let me explain this in a setting which hopefully will be followable, and that is history, the separation of present and past, is one of the most common experiences, one of the most common burdens we are conditioned to experience. Let me explain what I mean. We usually say that something that happens in the past is not incumbent on us, or maybe we just suffer the effects of it, or maybe we experience the blessing of it. But we live in a setting in which history literally becomes an excuse. Oh, God didn't say that to us. He said it to somebody else so that I am not having to deal with it. Most of us, for example, are taught to deal with the Old Testament and law in things that are not directly applicable to our lives. We are told simply that that is not applicable. It's like the time I went for my marriage blood test into the office, my wife's doctor, and I showed up and it was an OBGYN office, and without looking up, the nurse handed me an application and said, or a form, a health form, and said, please fill this out. And if you ever go into an OBGYN office as a male and you get one of those forms to fill out, you realize that the most common answer you have to give is NA, not applicable. Most of us are taught to view so much of Torah and law as simply not applicable, as if it were a strange world, a gender difference. And yet, notice how Moses addresses the people. God is speaking to this generation specifically. The burden is upon them. And by the way, when Moses does get around to explaining to succeeding generations everything from the Passover to the keeping of the law, he tells them this will be your responsibility. You will have to recreate. Remember the event of the Passover? In succeeding generations, in the midst of the narrative of the Passover in the book of Exodus, Moses directs the people, and in a day to come, you will have to instruct your children about this. And you're going to have to do something. You're going to have to recreate the meal. And you're going to have to dress like you did. And put on your running clothes like your great-great-grandparents did. And on that night, when the Lord passed through, the angel passed through, and passed over some and brought death upon the households of others, that's the night in which there was redemption. There is a reenactment of it, which shows that people in the present perceive the significance of what God did in the past. The past is not something that can be left behind. The past for Israel tells them who they are today and who they should be. Let's talk about it in a way that's understandable for us. Remembering is a present activity. It is something which we pursue. In the New Testament, the word used to describe remembrance, for example, when do this in remembrance of me, and it's written on the table that we use for the breaking of bread, and it's acted out in that recreation of the event we call the breaking of bread, in which there is actually a loaf of bread and a cup, which is symbolic of the cup that Jesus shared with his disciples through the fruit of the vine. That's how symbolic it is, because we use grape juice, and the symbolism is not lost on us because we say we are reenacting that event. Mimesis is the phrase. It's a simple Greek word, and it has the idea of reenactment. It's a dramatic word, and it means to literally play out once again. Mimesis is the way moral lessons are taught in Greek comedy and tragedy. Mimesis is the way you do things when you recreate an event, when a child mimics a parent, or when one generation plays at or mimics or plays out pantomimes, the events that took place to the preceding generation. Mimesis, or remembering, is the most common event, which is why we are told here that what Israel is supposed to do is to remember what the Lord has done for them. Remember verse 15. Remember the zenith of this text is to tell them, you will live in a way which is pleasing to God if you do this, if you remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there. You see, the way we remember is we usually say, well, they're lost or distant to us, or remember so-and-so because they're not here or absent, which led some to say that, for example, in the New Testament, the early Christian movement never remembered Jesus the way most of us remember things. Because Jesus is the one who told us that you don't have to remember me in the sense of being lost to you, for wherever two or three are gathered together in the midst, there I am in the midst of you. We remember not as someone who is lost and gone to us, that if we don't reenact this, we'll forget him. Like a child will forget a departed relative or something if they don't remember. We're talking about somebody who is present, like the Lord is present and with these people calling them. And in one real sense, we never remember Jesus the way we are called to remember numbers and dates and places and people. We are called to remember in the sense that we reenact as constant and as active and as present. History is not a problem for us to be overcome or a problem to be dealt with. We are called to remember as the pursuit of obedience, which is why the word remembrance, when it's used in the New Testament, has to do with the physical reenactment of the events that surrounded Jesus' life on the night he was betrayed. It is a narrative or storied event that we recreate, not because he is forgotten or might be forgotten, but because he is alive and well because of the resurrection and present to those of faith. We are told not only that we are to leave history behind us because I am still with you today, verse 1, we are told that we are supposed to live with God, the Lord your God. Over and over again, it's made intensely personal. This is the Lord speaking, I am your God. Verse 2, verse 6, verse 9, verse 11, and we'll hear it about a dozen more times just in one chapter. Do you think God, see, repetition in the biblical text is meant to reinforce. Repetition for us is literally the root of the English word boredom. But in the Hebrew scriptures, repetition is the most commonly used device to emphasize and to show importance. We would say it's reinforcement. Did you realize that the English word boredom actually has its root and its origins in the phrase repetition? That we equate repetition with boredom, oh, it's the same old thing over and over again, is to miss that repetition within biblical narratives is meant to reinforce, to literally enliven, make come alive, as though the phrase, I am the Lord your God, has a life of its own. That it's always present in explaining all of how we live our lives, or what we would call our purpose, devotion, orientation. Torah is personal. It's telling us
how to think, not simply what to think. You know, it's a lot easier for somebody to make up your mind for you than it is for you to make up your mind and do the right thing. It's part of the maturation process. It's what you hope to see in children when they not only start to make up their own mind. Some of us are just happy that they have a mind to make up. But still, the idea is that the goal is that not only that you will decide something. Some people think that personal liberty itself is enlivening. I tend to think that making the right choices, the choice itself is no virtue. But making the right choices, that's where virtue is found. And the joy of seeing right choices made, that is the display of virtue and maturity that the scriptures are after and, for example, parents should be after in their children. It's the experience, not simply that, ooh, they have a will. I know that I have a will. The question is not whether or not I have a will or whether I'll exercise it. The question is whether or not my will so correspond with God's will that they will be indiscernibly the same. Or that I will be able to pray as the Lord told me to pray, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. When there is no discord or disagreement, when I can hear Jesus say, ask whatever you want and it will be done for you, because I ask the same things that God wants. When what I will in my life corresponds so closely with what God wishes to accomplish that you cannot discern whether it is me or the Lord willing it, that is the blessed virtue of the will of God making sense in my life. I know you have a will. The question is whether or not your will corresponds with God's will. You see, the Lord teaches us not simply what it is to think, but teaches us how to think. As he says in verse 6, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Verse 7, don't have another God before me. It's very vague, actually. Just don't put anybody else in front of me. It's a matter of priorities. It's a matter explained by jealousy. It's a matter which is explained rather directly. The decrees, the statutes, the relation of covenant. The question for us is, have you heard this expression? The old expression is, the devil's in the details. The new expression is, God's in the details. Now, if you're someone like me, you like books like the Devil's Details, History of Footnotes in English Literature. It's a really cool book. I gotta get that book. I know most of you would be bored by it. The History of Footnotes? Yeah. Well, let's ask the question. Who's in the details? In the details of what it means to have no other gods before me, in the details of not making an idol, in the details of the things that we'll spend time with next week, but not today. In the details, who is in the details? We can approach the matter of law and Torah in this way. We can say, oh, God just wants the sentimentalities of my heart. He doesn't want me to get bogged down in specific things. He just wants me to mean the right things and to feel the right things or to want to do the right things. Or is it God who is in the details rather than the devil? Is it that God tells us what it means to understand that I am the Lord is that you do not have other gods. Remember what the people of Israel did when Moses went up on the mountain to receive more than the Ten Commandments? They were led by Aaron to throw all of their gold and silver into a pile, and as Aaron said, poof, I will jump the golden bovine. And remember the words in the book of Exodus used to describe this golden bovine? Hear, Israel, the gods who brought you out of a land of slavery. And Moses was told, go down, because there's a sound of war in the camp. They had wonderful spiritual intentions, didn't they? But they were wrong in the details. The golden bovine was not the God who led them out of the land of Egypt. The God who was meeting Moses up on the mountain that they were too afraid to approach they were falling down before the God of the golden bovine. They got the details wrong. They may be that honoring God is figuring out the details of Corella. Why? Same reason it was my finding out what pleased Anita. She likes chocolate. Kilo's a particular kind of chocolate. Some days she likes chocolate with almonds in it. Sometimes she just likes plain old chocolate. She's always liked Fannie Mae. She's always liked certain kinds of Fannie Mae. You see, relationship with God is based on understanding not only the bigger picture, but also understanding the details in which God directs us in ways which can be pleasing to Him.